Hello everyone. I hope you're keeping well and enjoying the brighter days as we head into the May bank holiday weekend. It's been a really full week here at Sight for White. We've had Vision Aid in with us this week and the building was really full throughout. It was great to see so many members coming in, having conversations and trying things out. And of course, spending time together. It's definitely kept us on our toes, but in a good way. It shows the difference it makes when people are able to come in, connect, and access so much support in one place. As we move into May, we've got a number of events happening out in the community, and we're really looking forward to being out and about a bit more. We'll be starting this weekend with a Saturday morning at Chillerton Market, so if you are nearby, please do come and say hello. As always, thank you for being a part of Sight for White. I hope you have a great bank holiday weekend, and as always, look forward to seeing many of you very soon. Take care.
Here is this week's charity news for the 1st of May 2026. Tomorrow, Saturday, 4th of May, we will once again be holding our village market at Chillerton Village Hall, starting at 10 a.m. We will be serving homemade cake, coffee, and holding a raffle. Please come along and support the charity.
Swimming on Monday is cancelled due to the bank holiday, but will resume next Monday, the 11th of May. God's Hill Coffee Morning is on Tuesday at the Old Smithy Tea Rooms, God's Hill, between 10:30 a.m. and 12 p.m. Everyone is invited. Please pop along and meet our lovely volunteers, Yvonne and Linda.
Tandem biking is now on the Tuesday along the Cowes cycle track. If you would like a go on the tandem, please do not hesitate to call the office and we can arrange a suitable time.
Coffee and chat is on Wednesday, starting at 10 a.m. until 11:30 a.m. The cost is £2 to include drinks and cake. Staff are on hand to help with any queries and to demonstrate equipment. Also, at 11 a.m, we have our catch-up feedback session. This is an opportunity to let us know your views on our services and any activities or things you would like us to do for you. Please come along, but if you are unable to, please feel free to call the office and let us know your views so we can discuss it at the meeting. This was postponed from last week's coffee and chat due to Vision Aid proving very popular.
Mix and Mingle is on Thursday at Millbrook House. This group enjoys crafts, quizzes and entertainment. If you would like to put your name down on the list, please call the office.
Walk and Talk is next Friday between Yarmouth and Freshwater along the old railway line. The minibus will be leaving at 9:30 a.m. and will collect from Newport bus station before heading to Yarmouth to start the walk at 10:15 a.m. For more information or to put your name on the list, please call the office.
Yoga resumes on the 2nd of June. Please call the office for more details.
Our next
with sight loss session is next Friday the 8th at Millbrook House, starting at 10 a.m. This is open to everyone including family, but you need to call the office to book a space.
Advance notice for our next hearing cafe. This is on Monday the 11th of May at Brown's Golf Course, Sandown, between 10:30 and 12 p.m. This is open to everyone and staff will be on hand to speak to you.
Sainsbury's Newport has changed their shop layout following major refurbishment. If anyone would like to book a route familiarisation session with Emma, our trainee mobility officer, please call the office and she will be able to book you in a time.
We have been invited to the Royal Victoria Yacht Club's Disabilities Sailing Day on July the 18th between 11 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. Spaces are limited and if oversubscribed a ballot will be held. Please call the office if you are interested and would like more details.
We are busy planning our Christmas in July event on the 4th of July. We are appealing for good bric-a-brac, tombola prizes, jigsaws, books, raffle prizes, and any Christmas decorations. If you have any donations, please drop off at Millbrook House, or, if you can't, please call the office and we can arrange collection.
This is an urgent appeal to anyone who may know that could drive our minibus. We are in desperate need for volunteers to drive it, especially on a Thursday afternoon. If you have a neighbour, friend, relation who may be interested, please ask them to call the office and speak to Susan.
This is Den reading an article from Isle of Wight Radio. Freshwater Gate Cafe granted full premises licence. A seaside cafe on the Isle of Wight, described as a hub to meet, refuel and explore, has been granted a full premises licence. County Hall approved an application from Isle of Wight Bars for the Freshwater Gate Cafe, located opposite the Albion Hotel on Gate Lane. The venue will be licensed to open from 8 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. Monday to Friday. Six conditions are attached to the licence, covering areas such as the sale of alcohol, record keeping, and ensuring consideration for local residents, according to the Isle of Wight Council's website. In its application, Isle of Wight Bars said the licence would provide flexibility to maintain the premises, create jobs and offer alcoholic refreshments to customers and visitors. It also confirmed that any alcohol sold for consumption off-site would be served in reusable polycarbonate containers. Reacting on social media, the cafe described the decision as very good news and said there are great times ahead. As part of the application, the company outlined several measures to support licensing objectives, including staff training on conflict management and responsible alcohol sales, managing smoking and outdoor areas, and carrying out routine litter checks. Further commitments include displaying signage asking customers to respect neighbours and to leave quietly, maintaining clear evacuation procedures, and regularly monitoring noise levels. This is Den reading an article from the Island Echo. Scampi, the drone, to help reunite lost dogs with owners on the Isle of Wight. A volunteer search team dedicated to reuniting lost dogs with their owners on the Isle of Wight has received a major boost thanks to the donation of a new life-saving drone. Drone SAR, S-A-R, for Lost Dogs Isle of Wight, has been gifted a brand new DJI M4T drone by local charity Friends of the Animals, enhancing the group's ability to locate missing animals across the island. The team, made up entirely of volunteers, operates in a range of environments including farmland, woodland, cliffs and remote countryside. Searches are often carried out in challenging conditions and at all hours. Using drones equipped with thermal imaging, the group can cover large areas quickly and efficiently. This significantly improves the chances of finding lost or injured dogs, as well as livestock and other animals that may otherwise go unnoticed. The newly donated drone has been named Scampi, in memory of Friends of the Animals' late mascot. In keeping with the team's tradition, all drones are named after dogs that did not make it home. A spokesperson for Drone SAR for Lost Dogs IOW has said, "We are incredibly grateful to Friends of the Animals for this amazing donation. This drone will make a real difference to our searchers and ultimately help us bring more dogs home safely. As a volunteer team, all of our equipment is either personally funded or made possible through donations, So support like this is absolutely invaluable to us. Friends of the Animals, a well-known Isle of Wight charity, continues to support causes that directly benefit animals in the community. A representative from the charity has said, "We are proud to support the incredible work carried out by Drone SAR for Lost Dogs IOW. Their commitment to helping reunite lost dogs and other animals with their families is truly inspiring, and we are delighted to contribute towards that mission. The drone will now be used in ongoing and future search operations across the Isle of Wight, improving the team's ability to respond quickly when animals go missing. Drone SAR for Lost Dogs IOW is also seeking additional volunteers, including qualified drone pilots, ground searchers and dog handlers with trained search dogs."
This is the second part of the Talking News, read by Sam.
And Val, good morning.
We begin with more news items taken from the County Press and the Observer, starting with an article headlined, "MPs calls for pause on Solent levy as ferry prices set to rise." The Isle of Wight's MPs have urged the government to pause the introduction of an additional levy on some island ferry crossings in the joint letter, as a price hike is set to affect two Whitelink vessels from July. Whitelink announced a hike in ferry fares this week following the introduction of the Emissions Trading Scheme, ETS, which places a levy on ferries over 5,000 gross registered tonnes, affecting the company's St Clair and Victoria of Wight vessels. Ferry routes in Scotland are exempt until 2030, and vessels in Northern Ireland have been handed a 50% reduction, but Isle of Wight ferries over the given weight will be charged the full fee. Joe Robertson, Conservative MP for Isle of Wight East, and Richard Quigley, Labour MP for Isle of Wight West, have this week written to Chris MacDonald, MP, Parliamentary Under-Secretary of State for Industry in the Department for Energy, Security and Net Zero, to urge the government to pause and think again on applying the ETS to cross Solent travel. Mr. Robertson and Mr. Quigley took aim at the ferry companies, labelling them responsible for the extraordinarily high travel cost, and said they had loaded themselves with debt in the pursuit of shareholder profit, such that debt interest repayments alone far exceed the cost of the government's new charges. However, the letter details that the two MPs do not want any avoidable extra charge imposed externally, and called for the government to pause the scheme. In a statement to the County Press, Mr. Robertson described the levy as green taxes gone mad, and shows how out of touch the government is. He said, "At a time when the government is supposed to be helping us to tackle the cost of crossing the Solent, it is adding its own costs to the Portsmouth to Fishbourne route, which are not being applied to any other ferry service in the company. I voted against the charge in Parliament and spoke to the Minister, but he wasn't going to shift his position. The levy is supposed to be incentivised converting to battery-powered boats, but there is no grid capacity to charge large batteries in Portsmouth or Southampton, and won't be until mid-2030s. Mr. Quigley, who did not register a vote on the draft legislation when it was passed by the House of Commons on February the 11th, said, "I have met with the Minister twice, and he is due to visit the island to speak to both ferry companies about this issue. I'm aware there is a lot of concern from residents, so I am still pressing extremely hard for an exemption." Mr. Quigley had previously sought an exemption, but Chris MacDonald MP said the government did not plan to exempt Solent ferries from the ETS, and any impacts of the scheme will be considered in a review in 2028.
Ferry welcomes an eagle on board, by William Dalgleish. A ferry has marked its 30th birthday by welcoming a VIB, that is, a very important bird. Red Funnel's Red Eagle a vehicle ferry, celebrated the milestone on April the 29th by hosting an 11-year-old bald eagle named Kalani during her rehoming journey to the Isle of Wight. She was en route to the falconry experience at Robin Hill Country Park, where she is now settling in. Fran Collins, chief executive of Red Funnel, said, "Marking Red Eagle's 30th birthday with such a special passenger on board was the perfect way to celebrate. Eagles, kestrels, falcons and ospreys are all part of the island's natural heritage, and we're proud to work alongside animal charities and organisations like the Falconry Experience to help protect them. As Red Eagle celebrates this milestone, we look forward to many more years of making important crossings for everyone who calls the island home, including our feathered friends." Kalani travelled with her handler, Charlotte Bell, co-director of the Falconry Experience. Miss Bell said, "Kalani has settled in incredibly well in the short time that we've had her. She's building a strong bond with myself, and her confidence is growing every day. She's currently regrowing her damaged feathers. It's amazing to see her transformation already underway, and we can't wait for the day this beautiful bald eagle takes to the skies again." And during her time on board, Kalani visited the bridge and met crew members, including Mr. Matthew and Master Lewis. Red Eagle has appeared at significant events, including the Trafalgar 200 Fleet Review by Her Majesty the Queen in 2005, and was temporarily renamed Red Squirrel in 2008 to support the endangered native species. Kalani's journey means Red Funnel has now welcomed 3 bird-named ferries with their avian counterparts. Previously, a falcon travelled on the Red Falcon and a kestrel on the Red Kestrel. Red Funnel has said it now plans to welcome an osprey onto the Red Osprey to complete the set. Red Funnel previously said they are looking to replace its Rapture-class vessels, Red Osprey, Red Eagle and Red Falcon.
Oldest fish and chip shop closed. The oldest fish and chip shop on the island has shut and a repossession notice has been slapped on the door. Stotesbury's Fish and Chips on St James's Street in Newport was issued with the notice on April the 22nd. A sign on the door gives the leaseholders notice of repossession to pay £1,200 and recover their possessions. The popular shop opened its doors in 1897. Daniel Ditton, a former chef at the shop, took over the business in 2023. Southeast Enforcement, on behalf of the building's landlords, issued a notice to arrange to collect equipment and possessions from the premises before April the 29th. In March, the business owners said they were not closed permanently despite online speculation and had been shut due to technical issues.
MPs are divided in a Commons vote by Zach Saunders. The 2 Isle of Wight MPs have split over whether Keith Starmer should face a Commons investigation into claims he misled Parliament. On Tuesday, MPs voted against a motion to refer the Prime Minister to the Commons Privileges Committee over claims he misled Parliament about appointing Peter Mandelson as UK ambassador to the United States. The vote came after weeks of controversy over Lord Mandelson's past relationship with disgraced US financier Jeffrey Epstein and the way his appointment to Washington was handled inside government. Joe Robertson, Conservative MP for the Isle of Wight East, voted in favour of referring the Prime Minister to the Powerful Privileges Committee, backing a move which was ultimately defeated by 335 votes to 223. Richard Quigley, the Labour MP for the Isle of Wight West, voted against the motion, in line with Labour leadership's position. The Prime Minister has already sacked Lord Mandelson from the ambassadorial role and apologised to Epstein's victims, saying he was sorry for having believed Mandelson's lies and appointing him, and the appointment had he known the full extent of the relationship. However, opposition parties argue there are still unanswered questions about whether Mr. Starmer misled MPs when he told the Commons that due process was followed and that there had been no pressure whatsoever around Lord Mandelson's vetting. Mr. Starmer had urged his MPs to oppose what he described as a Conservative stunt, arguing existing committee hearings and procedures were already examining the issue. Mr. Robertson was among 100 Conservative MPs to back the referral, siding with colleagues who argued that only a Privileges Committee probe could fully resolve questions about whether Parliament was misled. Mr. Quigley was one of 333 Labour MPs who voted to block the move, as the government sought to close down the prospect of a formal standard-style inquiry into the Prime Minister. The defeat of the motion means the Privileges Committee will not, at this stage, examine whether the Prime Minister's assurances to MPs about due process in Lord Mandelson's appointment were accurate.
MPs call for action over relocations. An MP has written to the Minister for Care asking for urgent intervention after residents in care homes were moved away from their families to the mainland. Joe Robertson, Isle of Wight East MP, said this policy cannot become the norm and has also asked the Isle of Wight Council and the NHS what they are doing for those already sent across the Solent. 10 residents from 3 closed down care homes were not rehomed on the island due to a lack of provision. It followed the County Press's stories on Islander Graham Martin, who had already been moved against his family's wishes, and Richard Laws, who was facing an unwanted move. In response to the County Press's articles, Mr. Robertson said there is a crisis in social care all over the country, but it is particularly acute on the island. "It is a dire situation that shows no sign of improvement," he said. "First, the government needs to understand the unique challenges we face. I don't believe they do." He said he had recently visited St Mary's Hospital and saw the crisis in discharging people. "Last year, I brought the Health and Social Care Committee to the island to see the issues for themselves," he said. "I am also working on a report with the think tank Policy Exchange to address rural and coastal health inequalities. Over the next month, I am speaking at 2 regional conferences on the mainland to raise awareness of the issues we face. I have also written to the Minister for Care, Stephen Kinnock, asking for urgent intervention and to urge his government to stop redirecting funds to northern cities. Finally, I would like to see more councillors with experience and expertise in health and social care elected to the council on May the 7th. Meanwhile, Richard Quigley, MP for Isle of Wight West, said capacity on the island is severely limited. "The island has only a very small dementia-specific inpatient ward and no dedicated long-term NHS dementia ward. As a result, too many people with complex needs are treated far from home, often on the mainland, separating them from vital family support at an already distressing time. With an ageing population, this lack of local provision means our dementia services are simply not fit for purpose. I know how distressing this is for families who are already watching loved ones struggle with dementia, only to see them moved away from family support. I will continue working with the council to push for an adult social care budget that properly reflects the needs of our population, particularly those living with dementia."
Pretty Cheesed Off Councillor Vents About Road Closures by Rufus Pickles. A parish councillor has vented his frustration about the ridiculous number of road closures on the Isle of Wight, telling a public meeting there were 37 last Monday on April the 20th. Councillor Bryn Martin told Knighton and Whitwell parishioners of a journey from his Knighton home to Ventnor, mentioning five closures and no exits from a roundabout at Whitwell Village Hall on Monday, April the 27th. The representative said he was pretty cheesed off at this point and submitted a Freedom of Information request to County Hall, asking how many road closures there were on April the 20th. Other questions included how many were planned and manned, the number of staff working on them, and the volume of temporary traffic lights in operation. He told attendees there were 30 road closures planned in operation on Monday the 20th. There were six unplanned ones and one of them was unoperated. The remarkable thing is they couldn't tell me how many staff they had working, either Isle of Wight Council or Island Roads. They said they don't hold that information. I've written back to them and said I am not going to pursue this anymore, flogging a dead horse. But how the hell can you know who's working on your road? You have to pay them, don't you? It is frustrating, and I know we need to bear it, but it's just ridiculous, the number of closures on the island. Earlier in the meeting, Green Party councillor for Chale, Knighton and Shorewell, Claire Critchison, said she had received a lot of comments from people about the volume of roadworks. She said, I understand people's frustration with the numerous roadworks. When key routes are closed, it affects daily lives, and I know many are anxious about how much time and fuel they need to get around. The last few weeks have seen almost everywhere on the island affected. We do need the infrastructure upgrades, but coupled with a backlog due to the wet weather and the need to get as much done before the summer season, it has created road chaos. Many of the large projects in the south of the island have thankfully been completed, and there will be a further short closure for carriageway and ditching works. Island Roads have been approached for comment.
Appeal after pedestrians hit by lorry. Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary are appealing for witnesses following a serious collision outside the Southampton terminal of ferry firm Red Funnel last Friday. Police were called at 10:46 a.m. following reports of an incident involving a lorry and two pedestrians, a man and a woman in their 60s, at Town Quay. The woman sustained serious injuries and the man sustained serious and life-threatening injuries, and both were taken to hospital. As part of police inquiries, a 69-year-old man from Sandown was arrested on suspicion of causing serious injury by careless driving. He has since been released under investigation. Following the major incident, police thanked motorists for their patience as the Town Quay was closed for several hours before it could be reopened. The force would like to speak to any witnesses and, in particular, anyone with relevant dashcam footage of the incident or the moments leading up to it. If you have any information, you should call 101, quoting reference 4426-0191. 343.
A veteran celebrates his 101st birthday. Much loved Second World War veteran Alec Penstone celebrated his 101st birthday at the home where he is recovering from a visit to hospital. Alec turned 101 on Thursday, April the 23rd, and marked the milestone with a party at the Gouldings in Freshwater. A birthday party had been arranged by Alec's family, but after he was unexpectedly admitted to St Mary's Hospital, plans had to be changed. Luckily, the freshwater home provided a celebration during his stay as part of his recovery. Alec joined the Royal Navy as soon as he was old enough after completing specialist anti-submarine and underwater training. During the Second World War, he spent long periods below deck on HMS Campania and completed several Arctic convoys. He supported Operation Overlord in the D-Day landings in 1944 and was involved in the surrender of the German submarines around VE Day. He served another 14 months after the war in Europe finished as conflict continued in the East. Alec's blue birthday cake featured the HMS Campania and the North Russian Club, the Organization for Arctic Convoy Veterans.
Dementia UK visits to raise awareness. Senior figures from Dementia UK have visited the Isle of Wight. Chief Executive Hilda Hayo and Chair of Trustees Professor David Croysdale Appleby, alongside supporters, visited to raise awareness and support fundraising efforts. Aaron and Jesse Gulati presented the cheque to Ms. Hayo from funds raised at a recent charity dinner in Wootton. This donation will directly support Dementia UK's Admiral Nurse Service, providing specialist help to families affected by dementia. A question and answer session on dementia and end-of-life care was hosted by Joe Robertson MP at Bembridge Sailing Club. Hover Travel, a long-time supporter of Dementia UK's Admiral Nurses, has introduced a hover and walk event for the Isle of Wight Walking Festival, set to take place on May the 9th. Loretta Lale, Head of Marketing at Hover Travel, said, "Welcoming Dementia UK to the Isle of Wight was a privilege for our team, and it was incredibly moving to see the strength of local support for such an important cause. We are proud to play a part in raising both awareness and vital funds." The Hover and Walk event is free, with participants encouraged to fundraise for Dementia UK. To sign up, visit Eventbrite.
Gift of a New Drone to Help Find Missing Dogs by William Dalgaish. A new drone will soon be helping volunteers search for missing dogs on the Isle of Wight. The DJI M4T drone has been donated to Drone SAR for Lost Dogs Isle of Wight by Friends of the Animals. The drone is equipped with thermal imaging technology. A spokesperson for Drone SAR for Lost Dogs Isle of Wight said, "We are incredibly grateful to Friends of the Animals for this amazing donation. This drone will make a real difference to our searches and ultimately help us bring more dogs home safely. As a volunteer team, all of our equipment is either personally funded or made possible through donations, so support like this is absolutely invaluable to us. Drone SAR for Lost Dogs Isle of Wight is a volunteer-led group that uses drone technology to help find missing animals. Its drones are used to cover large areas of farmland, woodland, and remote countryside, often in challenging conditions and at any hour. The team's advanced equipment and thermal imaging allows them to quickly and efficiently locate animals that could otherwise go unseen. The new drone has been named Scampi in memory of the late mascot of Friends of the Animals. All of the group's drones are named after dogs who sadly did not make it home, serving as a tribute to the animals at the heart of their work." A spokesperson for Friends of the Animals said, "We are proud to support the incredible work carried out by Drone SAR for Lost Dogs Isle of Wight. Their commitment for helping reunite lost dogs and other animals with their families is truly inspiring, and we're delighted to contribute towards that mission. The new drone will now be used in both ongoing and future search operations across the island, giving the team greater capacity to respond quickly and effectively when dogs and livestock go missing. Have you got a story for the County Press? Contact the team in Newport via email at editor@iwcp.co.uk or call 01983 259 003.
Thief back in jail 3 days later. A prolific offender stole from the co-op just 3 days after he was handed a suspended sentence for a separate theft. Paul Smart, formerly of Fort Street, Sandown, and currently of HMP Lewis, has been jailed again. The 39-year-old appeared for sentencing via video link at the Isle of Wight Magistrates Court on Tuesday, April the 28th. On April the 25th, he pleaded guilty to theft and failure to comply with a community protection notice. The day before, on April the 24th, Smart entered the co-op in Sandown and stole hot food and cold coffee to the value of £16.50, Abby Winters, prosecuting, said. His offending was captured on CCTV. Smart was in breach of a suspended sentence handed to him for theft just a few days before on April the 21st. Smart was handed community orders in August 2025 and February 2026. Michael McGoldrick, defending, said Smart, who has over 220 offences to his name, has poor mental health, became homeless, and was sleeping in a doorway. Mr. McGoldrick said Smart knows the theft was stupid and had no explanation. As Smart's breach was just a few days into his suspended sentence, magistrates decided to sentence him to 8 weeks in prison.
A woman on drugs drove the wrong way on a one-way street, by the court reporter. A Mini Cooper driver caught driving erratically in a village for drug driving-related offences was handed her second driving ban within the space of just over 6 weeks. Susanna Hallett of Amherst Place in Ryde appeared at the Isle of Wight Magistrates Court on Tuesday, April the 21st. The 30-year-old admitted driving while unfit through drugs and driving without insurance on October the 7th last year. The court heard that at around 6 p.m, police on patrol at Winford near Newchurch saw Hallett driving a red Mini Cooper erratically, said Giles Fletcher, prosecuting. Officers initially observed the vehicle travelling at speed before it was driven the wrong way on a one-way street. She was pulled over in Chambers Drive, subsequently tested and was arrested. Mr. Fletcher also told magistrates the police stated Hallett's standard of driving was poor, which raised immediate concerns for road safety. Analysis showed she had cocaine, its breakdown product, benzlegonine, BZE, methadone and other substances in her system, which would have impaired her ability to drive, Mr. Fletcher added. It was also established that she was driving without valid insurance. For Hallett, Oscar Vincent said his client had made progress, complying well with a probation order linked to a drug driving case last month, and had secured part-time work as a healthcare assistant. Last month, Island magistrates handed Hallett a 20-month driving disqualification for two counts of drug driving and a single count of driving without insurance committed on June the 14th last year. On that occasion, Hallett was seen cutting a corner and was stopped by patrolling officers on Moreton Common, Sandown. Her vehicle was found to have no tax or insurance. The court noted that the October incident predated the ban she received last month. In the interests of justice, magistrates imposed a further 20-month driving ban and ordered it to run concurrently with last month's disqualification. Due to the overlap between the two disqualification periods, Hallett's overall ban was effectively extended by 3 months. She was also fined £80 and ordered to pay £85 in costs.
Impacts Award for Sailing Club Commodore. A sailing club commodore has been honoured for his dedication to the sport and his impact on the community. Peter Ball, Commodore of East Cowes Sailing Club, has received a Gold Impact Award from the Royal Yachting Association, RYA, in recognition of his significant contribution to sailing and water sports. Sarah Sutcliffe, Chief Executive of the RYA, said, "Peter has been selected as a recipient of this certification, which celebrates individuals who have made a significant and lasting impact through their dedication and passion for our sport. Mr. Ball played a key role in supporting Spanish sailor Danny Pick, who in 2024 became the first completely blind sailor to circumnavigate the Isle of Wight solo and unaided. He also championed youth water sports on East Cowes Esplanade." Mr. Ball said, "I accept this on behalf of the membership of the East Cowes Sailing Club, who have not only supported the vision, but given their time so freely to give back to the underprivileged children of East Cowes."
Choir concert raises hundreds to help the elderly. A charity concert has raised £700 for Age UK, Isle of Wight. New Church Male Voice Choir hosted the event at St Saviour's on the Cliff in Shanklin, where they performed alongside the Cotswold Male Voice Choir. Bob Cooper, a member of the New Church group, said, "For the members of New Church Male Voice Choir to be able to sing in concert with the renowned Cotswold Male Voice Choir was a great pleasure, and it showed the quality of the sounds that male voice choirs bring. We thank the Cotswold MVC and their supporters for coming to the island and helping us to raise the funds for Age UK Isle of Wight." Both choirs perform their own sets before joining together for two final pieces, including the Morte Christi and an American Trilogy. During the concert, 11-year-old pianist Kaylee Garby Tran performed works by Chopin, Mendelssohn and Bergmiller. She was presented with the choir's Bassett Stevens Award. The £700 total was raised through a retiring collection and from the choir's Christmas concert at Brighton.
League campaign ends on high. Newport Football Club finished their Wessex League campaign on a high as they completed a 3-0 win against Aldermaston on the Isle of Wight. Despite missing out on a playoff position, Port were keen to finish the season on a high at Westwood Park. Bolstered by the return of Matt Benford, George Holbrook and Mikey Tomsett, the team started strong and quickly converted there through G. Nash, bringing his goal tally to 40 for the season. Despite an attacking threat from the opposition, Newport maintained their lead into half-time. A quieter second half gave the hosts ample space to try for a second goal, and the goods came through substitute Jordan Brown from the edge of the box. Kudsi Mazambara then secured the results for the Islanders with his first goal for the club, palpably celebrated by all the players and fans, reflecting his popularity. Port finished the season in 7th place with a tally of 72 points. The team finished their season with a final fixture against Cowes Sports in the Gold Cup final.
The idyllic spot, one of the best places of visit, by Carlo Simone. A thoroughly idyllic island town has been named among the UK's best seaside spots to visit in 2026. cows featured alongside 15 other locations in a list from Time Out, which wanted to highlight the nation's extraordinary roster of seaside towns. Discussing the article, the publication shared, "Of course, being an island nation, the UK has no shortage of coastal spots. Prim, proper, picture postcard worthy ideals. Check. Remote, blustery retreats from stormy seas. Yep, plenty of that. Thrill-packed resort spots with something for everyone. Britain has all of the above and much more." Cowes was praised by Time Out for being the most Mediterranean place on the list, thanks to its warm temperatures and toasty, calm waters. It added, "Cowes is such a thoroughly idyllic seaside town that it almost seems a bit unreal." Alongside that, the town's grand promenade and colourful high street were not forgotten. Here you can find a very decent roster of sailing pubs, such as the Union Inn and the Anchor Inn, as well as plenty of excellent restaurants like the Garden and the Prickly Pear. Time Out added, "The walk around the coast to Gurnard along Queen's Road and the Egypt and Princess Esplanades is delightful and excellent for boat watching." The publication also brought up Cowes Week as a reason to visit this year, which will take place between August the 1st and the 7th. It is the regatta's 200th anniversary. They added, "Expect hundreds of boats and dozens of races every day, as well as, of course, the usual shoreside parties with live music and street entertainment." Located on the northern side of the island, Cowes will be the first port of call for those travelling from the Red Funnel Red Jets in Southampton. The town is well known for its yachting connections, even outside of the famous Cowes Week Regatta. Other events that take place here include the Round the Island Race and the start of the Cowes Torquay Powerboat Race. Outside of yachting, Cowes also hosts the Isle of Wight Literary Festival and White Proms at Northwood House every year. In terms of culture, you can visit Cowes Maritime Museum and the Sir Max Aitken Museum, which opens from May to September.
Missing man's body is found. Police searching for a missing man discovered a body in Cowes on Monday afternoon. Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary sealed off the area between Cross Street and the High Street, known as the Cut. Pedestrian access to nearby public toilets was blocked, with the activity focused in and around the facilities. Police confirmed the incident was linked to the search for missing Cowes man Mark James, aged 60.
Section on sport. Young Athletes Triumph at First Match of the Season by William Delgish. Isle of Wight athletes triumphed at the Wessex Young Athletes League 226 opening match. The Isle of Wight Athletes Club, which is the IWAC, clinched victory in both the Quad Kids and the overall athletic matches against Bournemouth AC, Pool Runners, Pool AC and New Forest Juniors. The competition took place under sunny skies, marking the beginnings of the new season with new national aid groups. Quad Kids now involves under-12s, while full athletic programmes are contested by male and female teams of under-14s, under-16s and under-18s. Under-20s participate in a non-scoring capacity. In Quad Kids, athletes compete in a 75-metre sprint, long jump, vortex throw and 600-metre earning points based on their performances, similar to a heptathlon or decathlon. Amelia Riggs topped the girls' field of 22 athletes, scoring 258 points with her sprint, long jump and vortex throwing performances. Wilfred Smith, a year fifth pupil, was the top scoring boy with his best performance in the 600 metres. The IWAC boys narrowly missed victory, scoring 753 points against pool runners' 756 points, but the girls' win by 143 points secured the overall match victory. And in the main match, IWAC athletes delivered outstanding performances. Under 14 girls Harriet Willows and Darcy Ettridge excelled in the 200 metres high jump and long jump. The quartet of Alessia Rieger, Daisy Taylor, Darcy Ettridge and Harriet Willows won the 4x100 metre relay. In the 16 girls events, Daisy Selway shone in the 300 metre sprint and 80 metre hurdles, while Holly Taylor secured second places in the 100 metre and the 200 metre. Alicia Feather impressed in the javelin, discus and shot put. And under 18 women, Sophie McCallum and Emily Greenwell won the 100 metres and the javelin respectively. Under 14, Simone Peruzweski secured wins in the 80 metre hurdles, long jump and javelin. And in the under 18 events, Isaac Fillimore triumphed in the 200 metre, 200 metre and the long jump, while team captain Noah Cherry excelled in the B-string 100 metre discus and shot put. IWAC finished with 292 points, followed by Bournemouth AC, Poole Runners, New Forest Juniors and Poole AC.
And now moving on to White Memories and Nostalgia, starting with Days Gone By. 125 years ago, in May 1901, the Deputy Governor of the island presided over a public meeting held at the Guildhall, Newport, held to arrange a homecoming ceremony for men returning from the South Africa campaign. He said 20 members of the island of volunteers were on their way home. The Liberal candidate for the island in 1895, Armin Wodehouse, 40, died at his London home just 2 weeks after an urgent operation. At a public meeting held to discuss the erection of a memorial to Queen Victoria, the Reverend Clement Smith asked for the County Press reporter to be ejected from the meeting because he felt hampered in what he wanted to say. His proposal was not popular with the crowd, who allowed the reporter to stay away.
100 years ago, in May 1926, the new headquarters of Ryde branch of the Labour Party at Star Street in Ryde was packed with strikers and their wives. A Bochum farmer promised to give a pig for a weight-guessing competition at the next Gilton market. Money raised went to the county hospital.
75 years ago, in May 1951, two members of the Gloucestershire Regiment, Corporal William Armstrong of Ventnor and Private Philip Wade of Brading, were reported missing in Korea. More than 300 pensioners from all over the country were enjoying a holiday courtesy of the Ventnor area of the Caterers Association of Great Britain as part of the Festival of Britain. The holiday was provided at the rate of 3 guineas a head. One of the island's best-known mariners, Ernest Croucher, died aged 88.
50 years ago, in May 1976, Freshwater and Totland got their first carnival queen in 18 years. Susan Vine, 18, of Parkway, Freshwater, took the prestigious honour after the West Wight Community Association formed a new carnival committee. The island's Liberal MP, Stephen Ross, explained why he had a poster in his window supporting a Labour candidate in the Medina Borough Council elections. Mr. Ross said he was supporting the candidate, Robert Ford, because there was no Liberal candidate standing in the ward. A plan to ban most traffic from Newtown on conservation grounds was abandoned by the Isle of Wight County Council's Road Subcommittee.
commemorating defence of town during the Blitz. A weekend of events will commemorate the defence of Cowes. The annual ceremony will honour the Polish destroyer ORP Bliskowica and the people who lost their lives during the Blitz on Cowes and East Cowes. On Saturday, May the 9th, at noon, an ecumenical service and reflaying will take place at the communal war grave in East Cowes, Kingston Cemetery. Following this, a short ceremony will be held at King's Square, East Cowes, at 2 p.m. The Polish musical talent will be showcased at Holy Trinity Church, Queen's Road, West Cowes, at 6:30 p.m. The singing Chopin trio, consisting of mezzo-soprano Magdalena Wojciechowska, violinist Katarzyna Ratajczyk, and pianist Aksin, will perform a recital of music by the Polish composer Chopin and his contemporaries. Their international experience ranges from concert productions of Les Miserables and The Lion King to refined chamber music artistry. Tickets will be sold online or at the door. Sunday, May the 10th, we'll see a service at Frankie Place at noon, remembering the defence of Cowes and East Cowes by the ORP Bliskowica. The Medina Marching Band will accompany the service, playing respective national anthems. The main commemoration event will take place at the West Cowes Parade Bandstand. The public is welcome to join representatives from Poland's diplomatic corps, military personnel, dignitaries and society guests. Medina Marching Band will start playing at 1:30 p.m. and the formal ceremony will begin at 2 p.m. The ceremony will include an ecumenical service with the singing of hymns, laying of wreaths and playing of national anthems. Speeches will provide a brief history of the wartime blitz on the towns. A commemoration of the loss of ORP Grom in 1940, the sistership to ORP Bliskowica, will also be held. The ORP Bliskowica, under the command of Captain Frankie, played a crucial role in defending Cowes and East Cowes during the Blitz.
Author reveals an island link to Cold War spy scandal. A new book has uncovered a forgotten link between the Isle of Wight and one of Britain's most infamous spy scandals. Journalist and author Robert Verkaig, who lives in West Wight, said one of the Cambridge Five had spent time on the island before defecting to Russia. His latest book, The Writer and the Traitor, explores the friendship between author Graham Greene and the double agent Kim Philby. Mr. Verkaig said one of the traitors used to visit the Isle of Wight before he defected to Russia. Donald McLean, one of the Cambridge Five, had a friend of Kim Philby and used to stay with the journalist Philip Toynbee in Yafford, just a mile away from where I live. The book details how McLean sought refuge on the island during the final years of the Second World War. Mr. Verkaig said, I had no idea that one of the characters I was writing about had come to the same part of the island to escape the pressures of betraying his country. By 1945, McLean and Toynbee were both alcoholics and they spent their time together taking part in mammoth drinking binges. The Writer and the Traitor is published by Welbeck and was released on April the 9th.
Brought to standstill in strike of 1926. A century ago, the Isle of Wight found itself drawn into one of the most dramatic confrontations in modern British history. In May 1926, as the national coal strike tipped into a nationwide general strike, the effects of the dispute rippled across the Solent, reshaping daily life on the island where the population was barely half the size of what it is today. The general strike called by the Trades Union Congress, was triggered by the collapse of negotiations over the coal industry. Government subsidies that protected miners from wage cuts were coming to an end, and proposals for longer hours and lower pay were fiercely resisted. When talks broke down, miners downed tools at midnight on April the 30th. Within days, a grave decision, as it was described, was taken to call out workers in key supporting industries. Among the first affected was the printing trade. Printers, compositors and telegraphists were essential to the flow of news and opinion, so their withdrawal threatened both commercial newspapers and the government's ability to communicate with the public. In London, tensions exploded at the Daily Mail on May the 2nd, when staff refused to print an editorial entitled For King and Country. When editors declined to alter the article, printers, machine managers, stereotypers and packers walked out. There was no Daily Mail the following day, a powerful symbol of the brewing storm. On the Isle of Wight, the impact was less dramatic, but no less significant. The island's economy and the communications relied heavily on coal fuel transport, and a small but skilled printing workforce. When the general strike formally began on May the 4th, railway men, transport workers and printers were instructed by their unions to stop work. Around 250 railway workers, a similar number of transport staff and about 60 printers, mainly compositors and mechanics, came out in sympathy with the miners. Crucially, there were no local disputes between employers and employees. All traffic was at a standstill on the railways and at Newport Quay.
As the Isle of Wight County Press stressed at the time, the action was entirely about union loyalty, not local grievances. The county press itself became a telling barometer of the strike's effects. On Saturday, May the 8th, it appeared as a curtailed four-page edition. In a front-page notice, the management explained that many long-serving staff, some with more than 40 years' service, had felt compelled to comply with their union's call. As a result, news was reduced, display advertising suspended, and only the most urgent notices printed. The paper thanked advertisers and local supporters for their patience. The presses did not fail silent altogether. Surviving references show that the county press continued to publish and later even printed political material, including the Labour pamphlets, Reflections on the Great Strike. Government strike news sheets also noted that island printers returned to work relatively quickly. Beyond the newsroom, the strike reshaped everyday life. All railway traffic ceased, and most shipping workers, members of the Transport and General Workers Union, downed the tools. In response, the island's Committee for Voluntary Services opened an office at the Employment Exchange. By noon on the first day, around 500 volunteers had enrolled when two volunteers drove a 3-ton steam lorry through Newport with supplies that were cheered by striking workers, a telling moment of goodwill. Coal and food supplies were the chief anxieties. Town councils in Newport and Ryde appointed emergency committees to oversee distribution, while special constables were sworn in to maintain order. In practice, order was never seriously threatened. Groups of strikers gathered daily outside the county press office in Union Street Ryde to read posted updates described as perfectly orderly and good-humoured. Persistent rumours of intimidation or sabotage were firmly rebutted by the paper as groundless. Milk supplies, critical concern, were handled with particular care. steam launches connected with the island, with Portsmouth carrying passengers and goods, while electric trams and many bus routes continued to run. The Southern Railway authorities, faced with an almost complete withdrawal of labour, managed to run a few trains from Ryde Pierhead to Ventnor, driven by company officials carrying the mail, perishable goods, school children and passengers. This strike roused little excitement in Cowes. Most of the men in the ship and boat building yards were trade unionists, but there were no stoppages. Three coal vessels arrived at Medina Wharf, but their cargoes were immediately seized by the government. Leisure filled some of the enforced downtime with football matches at Church Lytton. After 9 days, the general strike was called off on May the 12th.
And now on to my view, starting with The Peace of the West White Has Helped Heal Me by Jules Baker Smith. I didn't grow up imagining I'd end up living on an island. In fact, for most of my life, the Isle of Wight existed only as a vague holiday postcard in my mind, somewhere I went as a child, like so many others, not somewhere they stayed. Yet somehow, slowly, and then all at once, it became home. My life before the island was defined by movement. For 25 years, I've assisted the great and the good of the film industry all over the world, from directors like Alfonso Cuarón and Peter Howitt to actors Robert Downey Jr., Gerard Butler and Tom Holland. Everything operated on urgency. I built my career in environments where time was always short and expectations were always high. There was excitement and drama in that pace, a constant sense of possibility and glamour, but also a quiet exhaustion that crept in unnoticed. When you live surrounded by noise, you rarely realise how loud it actually is until it stops. The shift towards the Isle of Wight wasn't a single dramatic decision. It was a series of small moments, the kind that only makes sense in hindsight. A visit that felt unusually calming. A walk where no one seemed in a hurry. Space to think. So, I bought a small cottage, a place to escape the madness of my life. Then my parents moved here, so I spent more and more time on the island. My father got terminally sick in 2020, so I moved over full-time to care for him and support my mother, never really considering I would never leave. After my father passed and was buried here, my mother wanted to stay to be near him, and I could think of nowhere better to be. Professionally, I worried at first that stepping away from the mainland might mean stepping away from opportunity. Instead, the opposite happened. I met a like-minded person here, and we started our own film production company, the Isle Film Company. We are only 18 months in and doing really well. I realised this island could fulfil another lifelong dream of creating my own horse sanctuary, at the same time helping to support the equine community on the island. This has now begun, thanks to this wonderful place. Of course there are challenges, leaving your friends behind, and hoping they will visit, trying to make new friends, which has taken time. It was the biggest hurdle of starting life again here. I am single, an only child, with no children. I love all of that, but where some of my friends with children going to school gave them an immediate community, that wasn't the case for me. Adding to that, I was also grieving, with zero interest in people. So, after living here for 4 years, I had no friends. But gradually things changed, thanks mainly to my business partner, Lisa Henry, the most social person ever, and the freshwater bathers, my sea swimming friends. The cost of travelling to the mainland is a big subject for many, as the residence discount is still too small. It can make maintaining any semblance of your former life challenging, but so far, it's just about manageable. More on that topic another time. I love the fact I can't get lost. For someone who is directionally dyslexic, it's a wonderful comfort. The peace of West White has helped heal me in many ways that make me so thankful to have found this place.
Next section is on gardening. Alan shares simple trick for getting rid of weeds as weather warms up. Gardening guru Alan Titchmarsh is back once again with one of his ingenious tips for keeping your garden in order. And this time it involves the big one, weeds. Weeds thrive when they receive enough sunlight, which is why so many appear at once during spring. Have you started to see some already? I bet you have. They flourish in warm spots like gravel driveways or between paving slabs. But now Alan is on hand to help. Alan Titchmarsh's simple trick for getting rid of weeds. Getting rid of weeds can be incredibly difficult, as their roots often burrow deep into cracks or compact soil. Even when you remove the visible growth, it usually returns within weeks. However, Alan has shared a natural approach to eliminate these weeds without using chemical products or spending cash. All you require is a simple garden hoe and a bright day, as one of the best methods to destroy weeds is to harness the very sunshine that promotes their development. In a YouTube video, Alan explained, what you are trying to do with your Dutch hoe is to separate the weed from its roots, and that way it will cook once it's exposed to the sunshine. How do you get rid of gravel weeds? Alan explained, don't try to dig with the hoe. Remember, you're always skimming. The more the weed root you can expose to the drying rays of the sun, the quicker they will die. Just run a hoe over the gravel and cut through the weeds at their stem. Then leave the severed weed where it lies and tries to keep as much gravel clear from the now exposed roots. And as the weed has been freshly cut, it will be far more vulnerable, and on a sunny day, the powerful rays will completely dry it out.
Be informed and go and vote on May the 7th. By Rob Johnson, Isle of Wight Chamber of Commerce. May often arrives with a sense of the days being slightly lighter, both in reality but also mentally. Our tourist season begins to stir and many businesses shift from planning into delivery. This year seems to be going at a rate of knots that I haven't experienced before. Perhaps that's my own sense, but a backdrop of continued global tensions, fragile supply chains and uneven economic recovery reminds us that the geopolitical landscape remains unsettled, with decisions made far beyond our shores still influencing costs, confidence and opportunity here on the Isle of Wight. I certainly know that recent national shows such as The Apprentice and the global conflict will make the island an even more popular destination throughout this year. Island businesses are well practiced at navigating external pressures and always have been, whether it's adapting to global market shifts or responding to local change, resilience is part of our island fabric. Just this week, I continue to be encouraged by how many businesses are still investing in their people, reviewing their strategies and recruiting for a variety of roles, both senior and entry level. A great example of looking for growth rather than dwelling on uncertainty. During these times of change, this is where access and introduction to trusted networks, up-to-date insight and practical support make a tangible difference. Through events, policy engagement, training and peer connections, the Chamber exists to ensure island businesses are informed, represented and never facing challenges alone. If you haven't done so already, sign up to get the best from your local network of businesses and learn from those who are still making it work. Closer to home, May also brings local elections. While views may differ, local democracy is an important reminder that effective leadership, long-term thinking, and an island-wide joined-up approach are particularly important for the island. Strong local decision-making plays a vital role in shaping infrastructure, skills, transport, and the business environment that island firms rely on. Whatever the outcomes, what businesses value most is clarity, consistency, and a shared commitment to prioritising and progressing the island's future economy. Whilst the Chamber is proudly apolitical and non-partisan, we work closely with both local and national decision makers to ensure the voice of island business is heard. With local elections taking place on May the 7th, I would strongly encourage everyone to exercise their democratic right to vote, but take the time to understand what your local representatives can realistically deliver for you, your business and the wider community. If you care about the future of our island, make your voice count. Change doesn't happen from the sofa, and progress isn't driven by quiet frustration at home. Be informed, go vote, and help shape the Isle of Wight to what we all know it can be.
Saturday the 23rd of May, Notes at Noon, a superb classical music in Ryde, 12 p.m. Tickets £5 to £37.50. Take a moment in the middle of your day to enjoy beautiful live music in the heart of Ryde. Notes at Noon is a welcoming concert series bringing superb classical performances to the Isle of Wight. At Ryde Methodist Church, 14 Garfield Road, Ryde. Telephone number 0333 666 3366.
On Saturday the 2nd of May, a plant sale at 10 a.m, St Mary's Church Hall, High Street, Brading. Email leslie.attrell@me.com or call 0744 385 112. Also on the 2nd of May, Goddard's Folk and Ale Fest at 2 p.m. Celebrate the early May bank holiday at Goddard's Brewery with live folk music, Morris dancing, sea shanties, and a special festival beer. Three entry and great vibes all day. Goddard's Brewery Limited, Branstone. Email events.goddard@powdermonkeygroup.com or phone 01983 611 011. On the 9th of May, it's the Warburton Folk and Blues Fair at 11:30 a.m. Tickets £14. A one-day festival of folk and blues music over two stages, set in the beautiful grounds of Warburton Manor, Isle of Wight, Warburton Manor, Newport. Email iwfoodandfolk@gmail.com or phone 075 324 202 75. And on Saturday the 23rd of May, live music with Tapestry Duo at 3 p.m. Live acoustic music from Tapestry Duo brings smooth country and folk harmonies to a relaxed Saturday afternoon at the Vintage Tractor and Steam Weekender, Goddard's Brewery, Branstone. Email events.goddardsbrewery@powdermonkeygroup.com or phone 01983 611 011.
Monday, the 4th and 5th of May, live music from Folklore, Bank Holiday Monday, the 4th, at 3 p.m. Unwind this Bank Holiday Monday with the elegant sounds of live violin, blending folk, jazz and cafe charm in a relaxed afternoon setting at Goddard's Brewery Limited, Branstone. Events, Goddard's at powdermonkeygroup.com. Telephone number 01983611011. Also, Charlie Lovell Jones, the Brooke Violin Concerto with the Isle of Wight Symphony and Jonathan Butcher at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday the 16th at the Medina Theatre, Fairlie Road, Newport. Also, Live Jazz Sundays at 2 p.m. on Sunday the 3rd. Join us every Sunday of the month for live jazz from local island musicians, the Garlic Farm Shop and Restaurant, Mersley Lane, Newchurch. Inquiries at thegarlicfarm.co.uk, all lowercasing, 01983865378.
Lecture Explores Museum. The latest Art Society Isle of Wight lecture is set to highlight the eclectic collection of the Russell Coates Art Gallery and Museum. Led by Dr. James Taylor, the session on May the 5th will explore the Victorian and Edwardian artworks funded by Sir Merton and Lady Annie Russell Coates' ownership of the Royal Bath Hotel and astute art dealing, partly inspired by their world travels. The museum, in their former seaside home on the East Cliff of Bournemouth, also houses modern British art, including Dante Gabriel Rossetti's Venus, Turner of Hearts. The talk will feature the museum's range of female subjects. The lecture will take place at Northwood House in Cowes and via Zoom. Tickets are £10 and can be purchased via the Arts Society Isle of Wight website.
On Sunday the 3rd of May, Gardening Galore at 10 a.m. in Rookley Village Association is delighted to announce the return of its much-loved Gardening Galore event, taking place on Sunday the 3rd of May from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at Rookley Village Hall and Sports Field, Highwood Rain, Rookley. Hall bookings at rookley.org, all lowercasing.
And on to readers' letters, starting with Money Would Be Better Spent by Penelope Baker of Lake. In reply to Richard Eltringham's letter, County Press, 24th of April 2026, protection from an undersea train tunnel fixed link in the Solent would cover protection from destruction of seabed and everything therein, including fish stocks. Avoidance of such a link also protecting international military naval movements currently so vital to national security, as covered in the national media. A fraction of the cost of such an irresponsible project would be much better spent investing in amending the island plan, which fails to allocate land for renewable energy, and investing in such, although land is needed for solar and of course wind turbines, the government having removed the onshore ban as a priority. Transforming the island to a renewable energy hub being an essential move to energy security and economic growth, and a way to government financial support not appreciated by so many here. Speaking of Richard Eltringham from East Cowes, incident shows island's mobility is easily severed. The suspension of Red Funnel's vehicle ferry following a lorry and pedestrian collision on Town Quay once again exposes the island's dependence on mainland incidents we cannot influence. Emergency services closed the road from the Holiday Inn to the terminal, and within minutes all vehicle sailings were halted. Red jets continued, but the island's primary vehicular route was effectively cut off by a single event occurring entirely off-island. This is the fragility we continue to accept as our transport system. It is not resilience, it is structural vulnerability. When a mainland emergency can sever an island's mobility, the case for a fixed link becomes a matter of continuity, not ideology. Infrastructure should not collapse whenever Town Quay is closed.
Talk on the Illustrator of Pooh. A literary evening will shine a light on an illustrator of some of the most beloved children's books. Author James Campbell will visit the Medina Bookshop in Cowes on May the 7th to discuss his latest work on E.H. Shepherd, the artist known for bringing Winnie the Pooh and The Wind in the Willows to life. Shepherd's drawings of childhood imagination stood in sharp contrast to his equally accomplished work as a First War artist, where he sketched the Western Front. Paul Armfield, manager of Medina Bookshop, said, "James has done a great job in bringing the artist to life on the page, and his portrait is E.H. Shepherd in both affectionate and full of surprising revelations. Many people know Shepherd for Pooh, but far fewer know about his work as a war artist or his sharp wit as a cartoonist." This event will be a real treat for anyone who loves illustration or literary history. The event begins at 7 p.m. with tickets costing £5.
A County Press column, Brought Back Memories of Japan, by Claire Grant Ventner. "I was very interested in Catherine James's column about Japan, County Press, 17th of April 2026, with pictures of the Peace Memorial in Hiroshima post the dropping of the atomic bomb in August 1945. In April 2001, 25 years ago, I was there when all the famous cherry trees were gloriously in blossom. I had joined a United Nations group, only myself from the Isle of Wight. Like Catherine James, I certainly cried going round the large museum dedicated to those that had died. The photo attached is a small area remembering the children killed, hence the fresh flowers on the left. Peace, Please is a child's drawing with the bomb on the left of a little girl screaming."
Could be cleared in a morning. Tony Pierce of Ventnor. The Isle of Wight Council should be in the Guinness Book of Records for keeping the Bath Road in Ventnor shut for 2.5 years. The reason? A partial collapse of a section of the wall that runs up halfway of Bath Road. I walk past that wall most days. It hasn't moved an inch. In the morning it could be cleared. Put up a couple of your red barriers, weighed down against the wall, and please open the road. It's affecting local residents, businesses on the esplanade, and holidaymakers on the beach. Vehicles have their exhaust pumping out in front of the restaurants, tea rooms and pubs because they can't pass each other. You hopeless councillors, get down there and open your eyes.
And that concludes the second part of the Talking News. So it's goodbye from Sam.
And goodbye from Val.
The BBC In Touch programme follows, and the scaffolding news follows that.
Hello. On the 7th of May, voters throughout the UK will be exercising their democratic right to vote independently and in secret. Some for their choice of local councillors in England, and in Scotland and Wales for those who will represent them in their national parliaments. But for blind and partially sighted voters, the choice is more complicated. Not only who to vote for, but how to cast their vote in a way which guarantees that secrecy and independence. The truth is, we still haven't solved that problem completely yet. But the fact that we're edging towards a solution is partly due to the woman who took her case to the High Court 7 years ago, and the judge who decided that casting your vote using a tactile template across your voting paper, without being totally sure who you were voting for, was a parody of the electoral system. And that's a direct quote. Well, that woman was Rachel Andrews, and she joins us. Rachel, just remind us of the circumstances in which you brought that case.
I originally had sort of dabblings with my local council in 2015. And at that time, I wasn't even provided with a tactile voting device. So with the support of the RNIB and my legal team, we decided to take it to judicial review because we should, as you say, have a secret and independent vote. And we were not getting that. Proxy voting is not secret and it's not independent. And postal vote, again, not secret and not independent. I know a lot of people favour it because they can do it in their own home with the help of a family member. But again, that's not secret and it's not independent. And my husband is completely blind, as visually impaired as I am. So that was not an option to me, even if I had wanted it. So I wanted what everybody else has, which is independence and secrecy.
Were you surprised at the result and the vehemence of the judge?
I was, actually, yes. He seemed genuinely outraged that we weren't getting what we are constitutionally supposed to have.
Well, do stay with us, because that decision, which basically established that the existing situation in the UK was illegal, led to a flurry of activity. A survey by the RNIB of people's experiences, a referral to the Cabinet Office for solutions, and a heightened search for more sophisticated solutions than a piece of plastic. Not all of the proposals are revolutionary. The TVDs, or tactile voting devices, are still in use. But in one Scottish city at least, they have been upgraded. Our Scotland reporter Ian Hamilton has been finding out how.
I'm in Edinburgh, but you can probably tell that by the sound of the bagpipes. And I'm standing just outside the city chambers in the city. On the 7th of May, we're going to be voting a new Scottish Parliament, 129 MSPs. But for someone like me who's blind, what will that experience be like? Well, they've introduced a new template system, so I'm going to go in here and find out how that's going to work.
I am Katrina Burness. I am the Parliamentary and Policy Manager for RNIB Scotland. And we have the alternative to the tactile voting device, which is a card ballot paper overlay.
For those of you who have used a plastic old overlay, you may remember you pulled back your flap and you made your mark. But you were never quite convinced you were lined up with the boxes. This new system in Scotland is a cardboard overlay with the squares cut out to match exactly where you vote. There's also braille numbers and embossed numbers, so you should know who you're voting for.
We've got two samples here at the Scottish Parliament elections. They're voters of two votes, one for the constituency and one for the regional list. We have overlays that have been cut to match the ballot papers for constituency and for regional list. And the sample that we've got of the regional list extends to 27 boxes.
Are they custom made then for each vote?
Yes, they can be cut to fit. So if you had five candidates on the constituency list, then the overlay would have five boxes.
My name is Ken Reid and I am an aged voter who's done it many times before.
The new overlay, is it better?
I think it is much better. I used the old plastic tactile voting device on a number of occasions and I used to think it was good. And then I was involved in some research in the discussions that have been going on. And I discovered that most of the time I was probably putting my cross outside the box. And it may not have been counted. You hand it back, it then shows which window you've opened. Your privacy has gone. Anybody who looks at that TVD knows who you voted for. In the past, I've actually opened all the windows just so they get fooled.
I thought that was just me, did that?
I'm Chris Hycock. I'm the Deputy Returning Officer for the City of Edinburgh Council and Secretary of the Electoral Management Board for Scotland.
Tell me about the new template, because this is the first place in the UK you're going to be testing this out, is that correct?
They've been trialled in a few by-elections in Scotland already, but this is the first major parliamentary election across the whole of the country that they've been used.
So my name's Julie Wright, I work for the elections team and my role is election trainer. So we come in and we train 850 staff. So the main challenges are making sure that everybody is trained the same way, that everybody treats everybody the same way, that we have all the equipment there and that everyone knows how to use that equipment to be able to support all voters, and that everyone from the polls opening at 7 in the morning until 10 o'clock at night go through the same process. We have brought everyone in-house, so everyone comes in to training. We only have around 36 people at each session. We take them through the main things, like how to work the register and the proxy lists and how to issue papers. But we have a big section around accessibility, and we get people to practice putting papers on the template, going through the magnifying sheet that we have, the large print ballot papers that we have, and we make sure that people are comfortable.
Back to Ken Reid.
It's great to see a new system coming in that will help to make it easier for blind and partially sighted people to vote. It doesn't solve all the problems, but I think it is a great improvement.
Well, we understand, and it's also on the RNIB website, that these upgraded templates will be available in all Scottish polling stations for their parliamentary elections. Many people believe, including the RNIB in its survey, that the nearest we've come to a total solution which guarantees both independence and secrecy is something called the McGonagall Reader, which combines a tactile method of voting for your candidate of choice with audio in the same machine. Well, Duncan Johnson of PackFlap, the company which produced the machine, joins us. Duncan, just explain as succinctly as you can what the McGonagall Reader does and how it can be used independently.
So the McGonagall Reader sits on top of the ballot paper in the traditional sense that the TBDs do. The difference with the McGonagall Reader is that it has a series of tactile buttons which relate to the candidates as they appear on the ballot paper, with a information button at the top of it, which, when pressed, will read out aloud to the user, who will be wearing a pair of headphones so that nobody else can be availed of their information, the instructions for how to mark the ballot paper.
Election of councillors to any town city council. Vote for no more than three candidates by putting a cross in the box next to each of your choices.
The candidate buttons then relate individually to each candidate, and the user can navigate up and down these buttons and listen to the candidates as many times in any order that they want to.
Chowdhury Suresh, the Banana Party.
If there's a space where there's a button and there's nobody in the field, then it will announce that there's no candidate, so that they know that they can't mark off the bottom of the ballot paper. They're spaced as the vertical spacings are on the ballot paper, so that you're using the ballot paper the same as any other ballot paper that would be issued. When they've found the candidate, they're able to navigate to the right of the device, and there's a series of moulded windows and doors, we call them, which is a hinging door mechanism. When you found the right candidate and you navigate to the right, you can lift the door and fold it back, and you then can press down on the back of the door, and this announces that the candidate again, so that you can confirm that you've actually opened the right candidate as you had intended.
Yeah.
What it also does is it reveals the marking space that was underneath that door, and this aligns perfectly on the ballot paper so that when you use your pencil, you can mark for the candidate and you are not marking outside of the marking box on the ballot paper and therefore spoiling your ballot.
So the key is you're doing this all for yourself. The question is, though, how widespread is take-up? I mean, it was used, I think, in about half a dozen towns and cities in the 2024 general election. What about this time?
We've got 54 authorities who have the device currently, of which 39 are currently using it for this May's elections.
But of course, it's not just about adopting it, it's about people being able to use it and know how to use it on the day. How easily can it be used? Won't blind people have to have had the opportunity to try it out before the big night?
I was at an event about a month back, and a lady came in who had never experienced the McGonagall Reader before, and it took her 2 minutes from start to finish to be able to use it competently. She was pretty amazed. For most people, it was a simple process of finding the buttons and pressing them, and once they've found the button and know where to feel for, then it becomes instinctive then.
Well, in the meantime, a lot of us will still simply turn up at our local polling stations, either with a trusted companion or relying on help from polling station officers. Jackie Killeen is Director of Electoral Administration and Regulation at the Electoral Commission, which oversees voting in the UK. Jackie, just explain what help we are entitled to if we do just turn up on the day.
Thanks, Peter. So everyone in the UK who is eligible to vote has a legal right to vote independently and in secret at elections. They have a right to be assisted in casting their vote in a polling station on the day, and returning officers and all of the electoral teams that they employ to deliver the elections have obligations to ensure that that happens. So there's a set of guidance that we provide, and this has been updated in advance of these elections to make sure that well in advance of polling day, all polling station staff are trained, so they know their obligations. They know how to support all voters who come to the polling station, and they have material on the day that can help them check any decisions that they need to make in the circumstances.
So how sure can we be that, you know, that all polling station staff will know the rules? And at the recent Gorton and Denton by-election, the issue was raised of what's become known as family voting, i.e., you know, where people go into the polling booth who could be influencing the way their companion vote. Now, I think the Electoral Commission concluded there was no concrete evidence that this was happening. But will this not put doubts in some officials' minds when visually impaired people quite legitimately go along and want someone to accompany them to assist with voting?
The law is really clear that companions are a lawful and useful way for blind and partially sighted voters. We are really also very clear in our guidance and all of the information to all electoral services staff that this is the case. They do have to complete a declaration when they go into the polling station, as you'll know, Peter, to say that they're being accompanied by a companion to assist them in conducting their vote, and that is completely within the law, completely permissible, and all polling station staff will have been trained in advance to that effect. And we also have updated the information we provide to accredited observers so that they understand that this is a legitimate thing to, this is a legitimate way for people to be assisted.
And in fact, people who are there overseeing things, they can assist, can't they? Because I have to tell you that for all your assurances that people do get a lot of training, I've been stopped a couple of times by staff who just didn't know that I had a right to go in with someone.
Well, we do our best to try and make sure that everyone has got the information that they need. And it's also in something called the Polling Station Handbook, which will be in every single polling station.
You've heard in this programme about a lot of the things that are being done to try to make it possible to get Rachel Andrews' wish of having a totally independent vote. How close to that do you think we are, and what needs to be done, and how long is it going to take?
In the post-poll report for the 2024 general election, we still found that disabled voters in particular, their expectations fell some way behind non-disabled voters. So we think there is still progress that needs to be made. We've updated our statutory guidance. That's increased, we hope, the clarity and also the things that we are asking election staff to think about. So some of that has been about trying to improve the advance planning and the advance communication to all voters so that no one turns up on the day and, you know, has something that's surprising in an unpleasant way.
Can I just ask you quickly, there are some new rules, and in particular, in some elections, you are now required to provide ID. Can you just explain that and remind us what forms of ID are acceptable in this situation?
the only elections where voters are required to provide ID are the local elections in England. Acceptable forms of ID can include, for example, your passport, a driving license, including a provisional license, a blue badge, an identity card with what's known as a proof of age standard scheme on it, certain travel cards, a veterans card. So there's a wide range of acceptable registered official ID that can be used, even if it's expired, so long as you are still recognisable from that ID. But you don't need ID if you are voting in Scotland for the Scottish Parliament or in Wales for the Senate.
Let me just go back finally to Rachel Andrews. 7 years on from your groundbreaking court case, how far do you think that we've come and how much further do we have to go?
I think we've come a long way. For example, Duncan and the wonderful McGonagall reader, I'm a big fan of that. It's almost 99% there. The only thing that it doesn't do is actually confirm that you've made a mark. Sometimes you can get a pen that doesn't work. You can be given the pencil the wrong way up. I was in the referendum, was given it the wrong way up and didn't know that I hadn't actually made a mark. So that visual checking, that final thing, yes, I have made this mark. Not where have I made it, because the McGonagall reader does solve that. It's have I made it, is not there yet. So I think we've come a long way, but we have a further way to go. And the issue for me is that when it comes to devices, one size does not fit all. So I think we need a multiple way of voting. We need the idea of a proxy vote or a postal vote or a companion vote or a tactile voting device or an audio voting device for people who want to remain using those things. And also perhaps, and I know that I'm going to get looks and shouted down online about this, but we need to think about digital and telephone voting as well.
Which happens in, I think, Australia, New Zealand. There
is indeed, it does.
Digital voting does take place. All right, well, we have to ask you not who you're voting for, but how will you be casting your vote?
McGonagall reader, all the way.
Okay. Rachel Andrews, Jackie Killeen, Duncan Johnson, thank you all very much indeed. And we'd like to hear about your own voting experiences, good or bad, in the week to come. Email in touch at bbc.co.uk, or you can leave us voice messages on 0161 836 1338. For now, from me, Peter White, and today's producer, Fern Lullum, goodbye.
Scaffolding and skips news for the week commencing 4th of May 2026. In the Newport area, Litchfield House, Union Street, 66 St James Street, Newport area skips, 6 Southview.
The Ryde area, 141 High Street, 10 and 11 High Street, 77 George Street, Morrison's Daily, Union Street, 52 Union Street. The Ryde area skips, 14 Castle Street, 59 High Street, Bembridge.
Cowes and East Cowes area, 106 High Street, 15 to 16 Market Hill. Cowes area skips, 50 Fellows Road, 29 Elm Grove.
The Ventnor area, Ventnor Youth Centre, Victoria Street.
Sandown area, 52 Fitzroy Street, Alverston Farmhouse, Main Road, Alverston, and Ferncliff Path, Sandown.